And of course, we know about Elon Musk, South African, who did the Heil Hitler salute.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the 59 so-called, I think we should be cautious. I mean, 59, 49, we should be cautious of calling them refugees, firstly, because it certainly cheapens the many displaced people across the world who are truly unable to return to their countries for fear of persecution and killing. Secondly, I think that we need to dispose of the idea that all Afrikaners are farmers. They are not. Thirdly, we also need to dispose of the idea that only Afrikaners work this land. And I think that the way that their farming expertise has been centered is deeply offensive. The farm workers, the thousands of farm workers who die, some often at the hands of farm owners, white farm owners, is an absolutely underrepresented and an underspoken phenomena in this whole scenario. And I think that we should also reimagine what a multilateral world would look like if it decentered this kind of white malice, and if it actually decentered these manufactured convenient truths that people like Trump and his ilk are spewing. And we can also see that there's this resonance across the world. It's not just the United States. It's Italy, it's Germany, it's the United Kingdom, and so on. And I think quietness in general is in crisis, and it's responding with great vindictiveness and toxicity.
Lebohang Thakwa, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Research Fellow and Political Economist at Trade Collective Works. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KABU. Make a summer of memories with KABU and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, how cuts to Medicaid and Planned Parenthood could impact pregnancy in Oregon. An Oregon congresswoman who is also a doctor speaks out against the newly passed Big Beautiful Bill. And Portlanders fight for the programs they love as the budget gets tighter. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, May 22nd, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter is among those calling the Medicaid cuts cruel in the Republican budget that passed in the U.S. House, which heads next to the Senate. Dexter held a town hall with thousands of people calling in from throughout Oregon.
They need more money for their tax breaks. And so what we are doing is shining a light on it, making sure that we fight every step of the way. There were 537 amendments, many of them focused on the healthcare aspect of this enormously tragic and just, it's cruel. It's frankly corrupt in a lot of ways. This bill is a terrible thing. And so we want to make sure that people know what's in it. We discussed each of these amendments, and ultimately, Republicans are going to have to decide if they stand with the billionaires who don't need tax cuts, or they stand with their constituents who are deeply reliant on Medicaid. And showing that rural hospitals are going to close, healthcare access across all of our states is going to decrease. When we close one clinic or one hospital in any state, it squeezes people into fewer and fewer options, and we already have access issues. So what we're doing is limited in the minority. I'm not going to lie to you. We want to be in the majority so that we can take care of people. But when you're in the minority, especially with Speaker Johnson tightly controlling the votes as he is, we have to try to get them to find their courage. We need Republicans to break from the party. And we see fractures, whether it's the far right who is pushing for more absurd cuts, or the moderates who understand that they are really doing harm to their communities if they vote for this. And so we are really going to slow this down procedurally, personally, with social media, talking to reporters, talking to our constituents, doing town halls, trying to make sure that this doesn't see the light of day. And ultimately, it has to go to the Senate. We know the Senate is going to change the bill, and then it'll come back to us for a final vote. And every step of this process, we need people to share their perspectives. So you staying loud, you making sure that we hear from you is important for me. And it's also important if you live in other districts or if you have other family members who can share their perspectives. There's really nothing else we can do right now. And I also want to say that there is misinformation rampant out there. There literally are news media sources that are saying that we're not cutting Medicaid, and that is patently false. The Congressional Budget Office, it's a nonpartisan group, is very clear. The top 10% will grow their income 2 to 4% over the next 10 years, and the bottom 10% of Americans will lose 3 to 4% of their income. And we're talking about families who earn $30,000 to $40,000 a year or less. So this is really a tragic budget bill, and we need to do everything we can to fight it.
We have Tracy from Gresham.
As someone who is on Social Security and Medicare and have disabilities, kidney disease included, and I am living so concerned about them taking that not only away from me, but people who are in desperate need of Medicare and Social Security. What can I do as a person who's a Democrat, and how can I, in terms of reaching out, does it help for me to call Republican senators' offices and talk to them or their admin team to pass on information? Is that at all helpful?
Yeah. So first, thank you, Tracy. And you, like many folks, especially with disabilities or kidney disease, fall into that dual eligible population of Americans who have Medicare and Medicaid. And that also is true for many of our seniors as they get into longer term home care in nursing facility care. So there are many Americans who are in this dual coverage area where they're dependent on Medicare and Medicaid. I have many thousands of Republican constituents, and I want to be really clear that this is not a partisan issue. Healthcare access cannot be a partisan issue, that all of us need to care about keeping our communities healthy and secure, and having access to healthcare is foundational to that. We've been hearing from folks, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that you deserve healthcare. That is true, but we are the only nation that is rich and resourced and not providing full access to healthcare in the world. And we also have some of the worst health outcomes. So we as a nation have made a conscious choice not to provide universal healthcare. And that is foundational to why we're in this situation. If we all could agree that healthcare is a human right, this would be a non-conversation, that we all have agreed to that. So it's a value that we as Americans haven't established yet, and I hope that we will. So as far as what you can do to advocate, being here helps. I can't encourage people to do anything specifically, but certainly sharing your perspectives with people who have influence is important. Making sure that you find groups that align with your values, whether it's the ACLU or Indivisible or Healthcare for All. There's lots of different groups out there who will also help. And making sure that you share your perspectives with your representative is also something that's always helpful. Calling other representatives can be helpful at times, but I'll just share that we really pay attention to our constituent calls. I'm not necessarily advocating for or against calling other representatives, but I will say that when we get calls from people who are outside of our district, it's a lot less compelling than people who we take care of and are accountable to. But being clear with your family, with your friends, talking to them about what's going on.
And that was part of Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter's town hall last night. A new report shows rural Oregonians depend on Medicaid to cover childbirth at a very high rate, just as Congress weighs massive cuts to Medicaid. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon is one of the top 10 states with the highest share of women of childbearing age covered by Medicaid in rural areas. That's according to a new report from the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. Stephanie McDougall is a labor and delivery nurse and member of Oregon Nurses Association at Samaritan Health in Lebanon. The company just announced the potential closure of birthing centers in Lebanon and Lincoln City, the only hospitals in those areas, in order to cut costs. Many rural hospitals struggle financially, in part due to low Medicaid reimbursement rates. McDougall says the center's closure would devastate patients, many of whom already struggle with transportation.
To go to the next hospital would be near impossible for them. And that's outside of talking about life and death. Minutes matter when it comes to emergencies.
In part because Oregon adopted the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion, in rural Oregon, more than 31% of women of childbearing age are covered by Medicaid. That's 8 points higher than the national average and nearly 6 percentage points higher than the state's metro counties. As Congress weighs cutting $880 billion from Medicaid, Joan Alker of the Georgetown Center warns this could be one of the most consequential decisions in her years of tracking federal policy, especially for rural communities.
Rural communities tend to have lower income than metro areas. So Medicaid, as important as it is for moms and babies nationwide, is even more important in rural areas and small towns.
The report says in 2023, Medicaid covered nearly half of all births in rural areas. Researchers also note that infants in rural counties are more likely to have low birth weights compared to those in urban areas. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A legislative provision cutting Planned Parenthood off from Medicaid funding could have profound implications on healthcare delivery in Oregon and throughout the country. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports, it goes well beyond simply decreasing access to abortions.
Planned Parenthood says a provision barring it from receiving Medicaid funds could lead to one-third of its health centers being closed. About 200 of the nearly 600 centers are at risk, and most of them are in states where abortion is legal. Planned Parenthood is the nation's largest provider of abortions and of sex education, but it also offers other health services, including birth control, the morning after pill, gender-affirming care, HIV care, mental health aid, and cancer screening. State Medicaid money covers abortion in some states, but not others. Planned Parenthood President and CEO Alexis McGill Johnson said, quote, "We're in a fight for survival, not just for Planned Parenthood, but for the ability of everyone to get high-quality, non-judgmental health care," end quote. Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, a nonprofit organization which aims to eliminate abortion rights altogether, celebrated, saying, quote, "Congress took a big step toward stopping taxpayer funding of the big abortion industry," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Portland City Council passed a preliminary budget plan of $8.5 billion last night after a meeting that started at 9 a.m. Wednesday and lasted just before their midnight deadline to submit a balanced budget. And they heard from plenty of Portlanders trying to save programs that were on the budget chopping block. Here are just a few of the many who testified.
My name is Lydia Kiesling, and I'm a District 3 resident, mom of two young kids in PPS, and a member of Portland DSA. I'm also a writer and reported on Measure 110 for The Nation magazine. I had the privilege of speaking with many experts on the issues of homelessness, substance use disorder, and mental illness. I learned a lot from them about the ways Oregonians have been set up to fail by decades of underinvestment in programs that build healthy communities. The suffering on our streets that has led to Portland's doom loop discourse is rooted in problems that the mere presence of police cannot solve. Police cannot change the fact that Oregon was number 49 and 50 in the nation for substance use and mental health treatment access. Police cannot answer phones for the overworked case managers juggling three agencies to get their clients into housing. Police can't open a spot in a treatment program or give traumatized people therapy after years of sleeping outside. Police also can't watch your kids when the school day ends at 2:30 or 11:50 today, and after-school programs can cost hundreds of dollars a month. Police can't run summer camps, which can cost $300 a week and still don't cover a workday. Police can't unlock the bathrooms in a public park or clean them. Police can't give swim lessons. They can't staff our community centers. They can't make a sidewalk safer for a wheelchair or a stroller, and they can't fill a pothole. It is a fairy tale that policing combined with crowded temporary shelters can fill the void where a strong social safety net and affordable housing should be. Joyful, accessible community programs and spaces are crime prevention strategies. Please reject quick and brutal fixes disguised as safety and save the fairy tales for story time in a fully funded community center.
I'm here today in support of most of the mayor's proposed budget for fiscal year 2025-26. I do support an increase in funding for Portland Police Bureau because they can help get the drugs off of our streets, as well as Portland Street Response. I support continued funding for filling potholes, removing graffiti and derelict RVs and vehicles. I'm concerned about reduction in funding for park maintenance, particularly cleaning bathrooms and removing trash. I do support cuts for staffing where it makes sense, like bloated communication staffing members, management-heavy departments, administrative staffing bloat.
My name is Jonna Davis. I serve as the executive director of the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods. I also serve as the second vice president of the NAACP and the vice chair of Multnomah County's Advisory Committee to Sustainability and Innovation. I'm here before you to speak to you and to encourage you to make sure that in all of your debating that you are considering an equity lens, that community members have a seat at the table in the process to decide the future.
My name is Sarah Rattalay. I live in District 3. I'm a land use planner with more than 25 years of experience. I'm testifying today about the negative impacts to building permit timelines with proposed cuts to land use planning staff. I understand 6 land use planning positions are proposed to be cut from PP&D, even after recent extensive layoffs. And I recommend that the City Council reconsider these cuts. The current land use planning staffing levels in PP&D are at historic lows after recent layoffs, and project review and permit issuance are consistently delayed because there is not enough staff to meet timelines and cumulatively can result in months of delays. The city and state officials have expressed desire to spur development, especially housing development. Programs such as SDC waivers are exciting and could help to encourage more housing. However, if land use planning staffing is further reduced, there will be even more of a slowdown in review times and permit issuance. This is particularly important if more projects are expected to be submitted, spurred by the SDC waiver program. I encourage you to retain the land use planners that are currently on staff so that at least the timelines to permit issuance will be maintained as they are now and delays will not get worse.
My name is Allie Berman, and I'm the vice chair of the Portland Parks and Recreation Board. I'll be speaking on my own behalf. Portland Parks and Recreation manages and cares for 15% of Portland's land. That's more than 18 square miles of property, including green spaces, baseball fields, skate parks, community gardens, hiking trails, pools, and dog parks. Parks are Portland's backyard, an immense source of pride for the community. So when I saw that the mayor's proposed budget aimed to gut PP&R's already thin maintenance budget, I saw the future degradation of a massive swath of our city. These cuts include the elimination of the shifts of the swing shift crew, reduction in hours for cleaning, trash removal, bathroom cleaning, turf renovations, and garbage pickup. I'm heartened by the amendments that attempt to right that wrong. Reducing the park's maintenance budget is going to cause more problems than it will solve, especially around safety and cleanliness. Please find a way to protect our parks. I also want to adamantly oppose amendments which propose an 86% staff reduction to the tree code regulatory team of Portland's Urban Forestry Program. This would throw the city's tree programs into chaos, dismantling decades of work to protect and equitably grow its urban forest. Portland has spent years expanding its tree program, knowing that trees help lower temperatures. In the era of climate change, I can't fathom a reason Portland would back away from our urban forestry goals now.
My name is Jessica Elkin, and I'm the executive director of the James Beard Public Market, a soon-to-be 7-day-a-week public market that will celebrate Oregon's agricultural bounty, foster small business growth, and draw international, national, and regional visitors to our downtown city center. Thank you to Council President for adding $500,000 to the amendment package. We appreciate your support and urgency. However, it is critical that the city invest the full $1.5 million requested in the budget. Public markets are proven engines of economic development. Pike Place Market in Seattle draws more than 20 million visitors a year, creates thousands of jobs, and creates hundreds of millions in economic development. The James Beard Market can do the same for our city. With budget shortfalls looming, we need to act with urgency to make investments that create jobs, support small business, and generate tax revenue. Downtown Portland has long been challenged by the loss of foot traffic and vibrancy. James Beard Public Market is the economic development project that will change that. With investments from private and public supporters, we've purchased a historic building just steps from Pioneer Square. More than 100 small businesses have already applied to be permanent vendors in the market. Nearly half of those are BIPOC and women-owned. These small businesses are ready to invest in our downtown. Now we need to support them and invest in this budget. We are asking for a one-time investment of $1.5 million that will unlock $25 million in funding from the corporate, philanthropic, and state.
The city councilors will have another chance to make minor changes before they approve the final plan on June 18th. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy, down to 53. Tomorrow's weather, clouds continue, up to a high of 63. The quote of the day is from Fiona Shaw. I'm married to a very unusual person, but maybe it took a very unusual person to be willing to marry me. In California, a new bill would make birthing centers available to more low-income families. Suzanne Potter has that story.
California lawmakers are considering a bill to ease regulations on birth centers at a time when maternity wards are closing in many counties. Assembly Bill 55 streamlines the licensure process, which allows a birthing center to accept Medi-Cal, making midwifery care available to low-income families. Sandra Poole with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says the bill would also no longer require a birthing center to be within 30 minutes of a hospital.
And of course, if you're in an area that the labor and delivery has closed, that's going to be impossible. There's 12 counties in the state of California that have absolutely no labor and delivery wards at all in the county.
Birthing centers are non-hospital, home-like facilities for low-risk pregnancies. 40% of California's birthing centers have closed since 2020, and just 4 of the 37 remaining centers are licensed because the current licensing process is unnecessarily burdensome, according to a study published today from the Western Center on Law and Poverty, the California Black Women's Health Project, and the Black Women for Wellness Action Project. The study also surveyed patients on the merits of birthing centers. Holly Drayton is a mother and former doula from the Santa Barbara area.
For people to have that option would really give them the opportunity to choose the birth that they want in an environment where they do feel comfortable to labor in the way that they're supported to make it the best possible outcome.
Sarah Archer, a mother who supports birthing centers, says they are an important part of the state's healthcare system.
People deserve choices in the way they want to give birth, not just in a sterile hospital. It's a very safe, very quiet, beautiful, serene environment versus a medical setting.
The bill has passed the state assembly and is now before the state Senate Health Committee. I'm Suzanne Potter.
On May 25th, 2020, George Floyd's murder at the hands of Minneapolis police sparked a global protest against systemic racism. As the nation's about to get ready for the fifth anniversary of this terrible crime, police reforms in the U.S. are back under the microscope. Mike Moen has the story.
Just days before the fifth anniversary of George Floyd's murder, the Trump administration announced it'll try to end federal reform efforts involving Minneapolis police. City leaders and activists say it won't stop their work. The Justice Department yesterday said it's moving to get lawsuits dismissed that led to a proposed consent decree for the Minneapolis Police Department. Under the Biden administration, an investigation of MPD found widespread civil rights violations, including discrimination against Black people and Native Americans. Michelle Gross of the Communities United Against Police Brutality criticized the DOJ's latest move and its timing.
I think a lot of it is really just pour salt in the wound of the community that is still healing from that. And so I think it's very outrageous.
Justice Department officials say it was court deadlines, not the anniversary, that drove the announcement. They say the investigation relied on flawed methodologies and incomplete data. But Gross says problems remain, and they'll challenge the petition in court. City officials say they'll carry on with guidelines from the consent decree, citing progress from a new independent analysis. That report is tied to a separate agreement reached with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights following Floyd's murder. Gross says complying with those mandates is valuable, but adds the federal oversight is still needed.
There are some things in the DOJ consent decree that we wanted, particularly addressing things like overtime, addressing things like Minneapolis police interactions with youth.
On overtime, reform advocates say leaning on it too much leads to officer burnout, worsening the culture within the police force. Elsewhere, the Justice Department also is trying to undo reforms for the Louisville Police Department. This is Mike Moen.
Trump makes disputed claims about white genocide. With that story and more, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
President Donald Trump made fringe claims of white genocide in a meeting with South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa, citing death chants aimed at Afrikaans farmers. Ramaphosa, a successful businessman and leader of a multiracial and multi-party post-apartheid coalition, replied that the chants did not reflect government policy. A federal judge has ruled that 8 men from various nations deported to South Sudan were denied due process. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons calls them dangerous men who did get their day in court.
These individuals did receive due process. We are able to do this under this administration.
The Pentagon has formally accepted a $400 million luxury jet intended for Trump's use from the government of Qatar. A new survey shows small business owners are worried about the future, with fewer than a fifth planning to make long-term investments this year. Former Small Business Administration Deputy Director Dilawar Sayed says that's the worst number since the pandemic and blames tariffs and trade unpredictability.
Two-thirds of the 35 million small businesses import, and 97% of all exporters are small businesses. So folks may not think of small businesses being at the front end of the trade policy impact. They are at the tip of the spear.
Education leaders are sounding the alarm about affordability. Courtney Brown with Lumina Foundation says a new survey they did with Gallup found adults without a college degree think higher education is worth it, but few think they can afford it.
Almost 90% of adults without a degree or credential, so these are people that either are enrolled or they stopped out or they've never touched higher education. They have a belief in the value of higher education, yet only 30% of Americans believe that they have access to quality, affordable education.
Ohio lawmakers are advancing bipartisan legislation to give a tax break to working family caregivers. Jenny Carlson with AARP says other states and Congress should do the same.
Family caregivers are the backbone of the U.S. care system, providing over $21 billion worth of uncompensated care annually in Ohio.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
This is Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Awareness Month, with an event in Oregon that combines advocacy and poetry. An inaugural Native Elements Arts Festival kicks off in Santa Fe this week with these stories and more. Here's Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon, with National Native News.
May is Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Month, where community groups, tribal leaders, and advocates highlight the disproportionate levels of violence directed at Native people. Among the events held this month was the 5th annual Poetry in the Park event in Springfield, Oregon, which was sponsored by Ilulu Theater, the University of Oregon's Native American and Indigenous Studies Department, and the university's Indigenous Women's Wellness Group. Marta Clifford is an elder of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and an organizer of the event. She says she was inspired to hang red dresses from the trees in Heron Park after seeing an installation by First Nations artist Jamie Black. Clifford says the color red is very significant.
Many tribes believe that it is the color that the spirits can see, and it is a traditional color now for this program of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people, all people.
Clifford says all of the poems shared at the event were by Native writers and artists, and most of the readers are current Native or Indigenous students at the University of Oregon. One of them, Chumia Felice, is from the Yurok Tribe of California. He says the MMIW crisis hits home because he's friends with the family of Emily Risling, a UO Native student leader who went missing in the fall of 2021.
She disappeared just a few feet from my village. I know the family. I know it's definitely a lot of hurt and suffering is happening right now back home on the Yurok Reservation and the Hooper Reservations. A lot of missing people. A lot of unsolved cases, too.
One student, Erica Grenlos, is with the Colville Tribe. She recited a poem titled, I Am 10 Years Old, and is about a young girl who's kidnapped, raped, and murdered by a non-Native man with, quote, the gentlest smile.
I actually cried the first time I read this because I just felt it, and like as another Native woman myself, I just really felt it in my heart. They asked me if I wanted to switch my poem, but I talked with my mom and I felt like I was strong enough today to come out here and read this poem.
Another student, Mykesha Yepa of the Hickory Apache tribe, read Helen Betty Osborne by Marilyn Dumont. It's based on the 1971 abduction and murder of a 19-year-old Cree woman. It took 16 years for her four suspected killers to be tried, with only one serving time.
The poem definitely resonated with me because the metaphor of open season and how powerful it is and how much women are preyed upon, and I guess it's like a hunting season for women.
After the final reading, an honor song was given in the memory of missing and murdered Indigenous people, as well as the friends and families affected. Roses were handed out to the participants, and people who may be grieving or otherwise affected by the MMIP crisis were invited to talk with the students. And this week is the Native Elements Arts Festival and Market at the Santa Fe Botanical Garden and Convention Center in New Mexico. 160 Native American and Indigenous artists are expected to be featured at the market. A new honor, the Native Elements Distinguished Achievement Award, will be presented. The event will benefit the Botanical Garden, the Institute of American Indian Art Scholarship Fund, and the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 22nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter, the producers Annette Newell, and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.